Okay, let's call this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 18th, 2019, and it is exactly 3:15 p.m. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Denine Tuck, and to also thank Selman Holland, our current House Labor and Commerce Recording Secretary, and Eileen Keim, the LIO moderator. At this time, I'd like to remind everybody to silence their cell phones. So, present today are Representative Hannon, Representative Stutes, Representative Tallarico, Representative Fields, my co-chair, Representative Wong, and I'm Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, the other co-chair. We do have a quorum today to conduct business. There are several items on the agenda today. The first is a confirmation hearing, and then there are two bills. So to begin with, the confirmation hearing of the governor's appointee to the Real Estate Commission Board, and that is Michael Tavaliero. It is my understanding that Mr. Tavaliero, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, is online, and he will introduce himself and be available to answer any questions the committee may have. So, Mr. Tavaliero, are you online?
I am, Madam Chair.
So please introduce yourself for the record, and if you have some opening comments to make, we'd love to hear them.
Thank you very much. To the Chair, my name is Michael Tavaliero.
Sorry that I mispronounced it.
Not a problem. It's pretty common. Thank you to the chairs and committee members for giving me the opportunity of presenting myself before you today. I have been a licensee, a real estate licensee, since 2008, and greatly admire all the professionals in our industry. The real estate profession is a hugely functional industry in our state, accounting for a large portion of our economy. You see, the real estate industry is not just about selling property and making money. There's a much deeper emotional and pragmatic aspect to our industry. It is about bringing people together and giving them the tools to address the social and economic issues in their life. Buying a house is not just about making an investment in land, lumber, doors, roofing, windows, etc. It is really about home ownership, family, future, and happiness. It is about continuing to improve the quality of life in Alaska with the expansion of a professional real estate community. I've worked in commercial and residential, done large and small investments. I believe my experience and my love of the industry gives me a balanced foundation to participate on the commission. The real estate industry creates thousands of jobs and raises wages with capital investment, supports public education and public and private sector employees through various parts of the real estate transaction. Our local real estate professionals are a vital part of community development and growth in Alaska. But accomplishing these goals requires strong partnerships between the state legislature, local government, and the real estate industry. Efforts by the commission to develop professional standards like errors and omissions insurance and the development of the recovery fund are proudly substantial. But professional investigations and remedies which are meaningful and fair to the public must be foremost in the commission's mindset. Again, thank you for this opportunity to comment, and I appreciate your questions.
Thank you. Looks like we have some questions. Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Tavaliero. You recently wrote to the legislature regarding a Facebook post by someone named Carol Carmen, and I was trying to figure out, well, several things about this communication. First of all, were you communicating in your role as a gubernatorial appointee to the Real Estate Commission when you wrote, yes, totally agree, but the legislature, especially the House Majority and Senate leadership, are deaf to this opinion. Therein lies the frailty of opaque state government in the dark, wet recesses of a cave called Juneau.
And I guess my question is, how would that impact my ability to serve on the Real Estate Commission?
Well, Mr. Tavolaro, actually what I was asking was, were you writing that as a representative of the governor, or was that a personal opinion?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the clarification. It is a private opinion.
Could you elaborate on what you mean by the frailty of opaque state government in the dark, wet recesses of a cave called Juneau?
We need government to be more transparent, and that's why you and I serve the way we do.
follow up. In response to your email to the legislature, Senator Keel wrote back and said that decisions are made by representatives and senators who Alaskans elect and send to the state capitol. And you wrote back, LOL says the hound as he runs with the fox. Could you explain what that means?
Yeah, we've got to cover both sides of the coin. We've got to serve the state.
I guess what I'm looking for is, I don't understand what the phrase LOL says the hound as he runs with the fox means.
It's an old Sam Irwin comment that he wrote up when he was investigating Nixon.
Okay, so to whom are you comparing Senator Keel?
It was a comment, not a comparison.
Okay, well, I guess I'm just trying to figure out what the statement, I mean, it sounds metaphorical. I'm not familiar with the reference. The hounds running with the fox, is that a myth or an allegory or a fable, or what is it? I'm just trying to figure out what you were trying to say here.
Our job is to promote public interest, and that's really all I was doing.
Okay, but Mr. Tavolaro, you wrote back to Senator Keel and said, LOL, says the hound as he runs with the fox. So, I mean, a superficial or a cursory reading of this would suggest that you're comparing Senator Keel to a hound, I guess. I mean, that would be, I think, what someone would assume if they just read it. Is that actually what you were trying to say here, or were you trying to say something else? And if you were trying to say something else, what were you trying to say with this statement?
It was just a comment on our need for transparency.
Well, okay, but could you explain
how?
Yes, follow up. How could you? I get that you're trying to get transparency, but I'm reading the words, says the hound as he runs with the fox. How is that getting at transparency? Could you just explain what you're trying to say here? Because I'm not understanding it based on this explanation.
It's the big picture, sir. Our government needs to be transparent. I'm at a loss. What are you asking me?
I think, can I interject something here? I think the problem is, you mentioned that this is an old Sam Irwin statement, but I don't know what it means. Representative Fields doesn't know what it means. I don't know if anybody in the table or the audience knows what it means. What does that statement, LOL, which I think means laughing out loud, says the hound when it's running with a fox? What does that statement mean? Or what do you think it meant when you put it on Facebook?
I meant very simply that we need to be transparent. That's it's simple as that. It's about the entire process that we serve for our state. Simple enough.
Representative Fields.
I guess I'm just left concluding that it's incoherent, but I would like additional clarification on, you said that you derived this statement from Sam Irwin and Richard Nixon. Could you explain that in a little greater detail?
Sam Irwin was the prosecutor for Watergate. And when he was in his investigation, one of the difficult things that he was faced with was the opaqueness of the federal government and not willing to be transparent. I mean, after all, there's many things that were done wrong. Wouldn't you agree?
Okay, so getting follow-up, please. So getting back to the original statement, therein lies the frailty of opaque state government in the dark, wet recesses of a cave called Juno. Are you suggesting that state government, such as it exists right now, is comparable to Washington, D.C. under the Nixon administration? And that level of criminality, is that what you're saying here, or are you saying something else?
It is a flipping statement. I mean, you know, this suggestion is we just need more transparency. And I thought his remarks to me were right to point.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I can't say I'm enlightened about what says the hound as he runs with the fox means, but I guess we've tried to understand it.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Tavalero.
Tavalero. No Irio, it's just Tavalero.
Mr. Tavalero.
Thank you.
Your very abbreviated resume to us shows that you've been a licensed real estate agent in Alaska since 2008. Have you been a full-time realtor during that 10-year period?
Yes.
And could you tell me what you did for the 30 years between being a paralegal and becoming a realtor?
Small business owner.
Could you elaborate on the kinds of businesses that you owned, please?
I operated a transmission repair shop for 15 years and did other odd jobs and worked for other people during that time.
Follow-up?
Yes.
So you've been in the real estate industry for the last 10 years. Can you tell me what your vision and goals as a member of the Real Estate Commission would be to do? What would bring around more transparency for state government, or what would be your ideal goals for that commission?
I think the important thing that we need to be focusing on from a real estate commission standpoint is promoting a stronger level of professionalism in the real estate industry, but at the same time supporting and bringing in new licensees. We lost a lot of licensees for lack of renewal last year, and the question of why that happened, we have not figured out yet. And I would like the opportunity to encourage more people to get into the industry. But the single, probably most important part of the Real Estate Commission is protecting the public. And we serve as a consumer protection group. And that is something that I take very seriously.
Follow up.
One additional question or area of questioning. During your 10 years as a real estate agent in Alaska, have you been involved with the Real Estate Political Action Committee and organization? Have you served on the board in any capacity?
I've worked with the board. I've worked with their political process. I'm a realtor. In other words, I pay my dues every year.
So just to clarify,
follow-up.
You have not served on their board. You've not served on their political action committee. You've just been buying and selling real estate and paying dues to the organization.
No, I have. I have been asked to serve on their they have a political policy board that I served on. I've also served on their their ethics board briefly, and but I never served on the actual board itself.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further questions? Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tavolaro, what's the makeup of the board?
The Anchorage Real Estate Board?
The state board that you work with. You said you worked on various subcommittees or something like that.
Of the Anchorage Real Estate Board. Is that your question, sir?
Yeah, generally when you talk about the real estate board, we don't talk about the Anchorage Real Estate Board. So now
there's several boards through the National Association of Realtors that are established in Alaska. The only one that I've really ever worked with more on a peripheral basis is the Anchorage Real Estate Board.
Follow-up. Okay, I guess when Representative Hanna was asking about working with the board, I just assumed it was the state board, since we're talking about a state commission, and so I was a little confused.
This has nothing to do with the Alaska Real Estate Commission.
I'm sorry, what has nothing to do with the Alaska Real Estate Commission?
The Anchorage Real Estate Board is not a part of the Alaska Real Estate Commission, the way I understand it.
Thank you. No, I'm sure it isn't. What part of this? So, do you know the makeup of the state board? Are you familiar with the state board?
The commission. The Alaska Real Estate Commission, or are we talking about the Alaska Board of Realtors?
Thank you, the Board of Realtors.
Okay. I'm not familiar with the Board of Realtors.
Okay. I guess that's I'm sorry, last question. What part of the state do you work in?
I work South Central, Anchorage, Eagle River, Chugach, and the Valley.
Okay.
I've worked up in Fairbanks as well. Full disclosure, I have property up in North Pole, and I'm developing multi-family homes up there.
Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. What is the board that you are being currently appointed to?
The Alaska Real Estate Commission.
Follow up. Are you saying that with a question?
No, that's the answer. You said, what is the board that I'm being appointed to?
Correct.
Unless I missed. Yeah. So the appointment is for the Alaska Real Estate Commission.
Thank you.
And Mr. Tavolaro, can you tell us a little bit about what the Real Estate Board or the Real Estate Commission does?
Well, its function is twofold. Okay, it protects the public through the development of a regulatory environment for consumer protection. It also enhances and develops the actual real estate profession itself. It's involved in the testing. It's involved in the fees. All the general provisions for licensing are done through the Alaska Real Estate Commission.
So, Mr. Tavolaro, so your resume, it goes from education and then to the work experience, and you say that between your education at San Francisco State and your 2008 as a real estate licensee and associate broker. And you said you've worked in or owned small businesses. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the names of these small businesses, who you might have been employed with, et cetera, which is something that people often have on their resumes?
Sure. I own the AMCO Transmission franchise in Anchorage. for several years. And
what,
then
years,
after
what,
that,
years, I, what years were those, Mr. Tavalera?
Oh, boy. Back in the 80s. And then from there, I went into, I got out of the franchise side of transmission repair. And I worked that for many years afterwards until my body basically broke.
Can you tell us who you did? You own the this business.
I own the businesses. I own the businesses myself.
All of them.
Yes, ma'am.
So, early 80s was AMCO, and then what did you say? Transmission businesses. So, what were the names of those transmission businesses?
A transmission.
A?
AAC transmission.
Pardon me?
A accurate transmission.
A transmission.
No, A accurate transmission. The A accurate was for Yellow Page.
Accurate transmission.
A accurate.
Okay. And how long did you have that business?
All the way up to 2005, 2006, and then from there I went on disability, and from there I went into the to my real estate license encouraged by a friend in 08.
And you ever had any bankruptcies or anything like that with respect to any of the businesses that you owned?
No. But how would that impact my ability to serve the real estate committee?
Mr. Tavalero, I'm asking the questions. So I asked you whether you'd ever had any bankruptcies.
No, ma'am.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the conversation today started out with about transparency and the lack thereof. And it seems like every time we ask you a question, we have to kind of pull teeth just to get some basic information of what's the name of the business, when did you work there. Now we find out you're developing homes in North Pole. None of this is on your resume. It is the scantest resume I've ever seen. So we ask questions, and then we're getting kind of the old hound and fox kind of story. So I'm sorry, Ms. Tavalera. I find your responses a little lacking.
Representative Hannon.
Perhaps you could, through the chair, tell us, because it's not on your resume, you're a current license holder of a real estate license, but you're developing property. Can you tell us, you own the contracting business that's developing it, or are you in partnership? And if so, the name of that business.
Actually, I am not doing it as a realtor. I'm doing it with my wife for retirement purposes. So what we're doing is we've found a contractor in the Fairbanks area, and we're going to the bank, and we built one, and hopefully we'll build two or three more.
Representative Hannon.
And is your use of a real estate license important in that transaction at all, whether it's in the rental or the finding of a contractor? Are these contractors who also hold real estate licenses?
I do get a commission as a result of the completed project, but I am not involved in the rentals. We contract with a property manager.
Representative Hannon.
The last few years, there's been pieces of legislation dealing with a statewide residential building code. Are you familiar with those proposals previously? Do you have an opinion about them? Do you see a residential building code in Alaska as good, bad, and different?
It's really outside of my area. I really don't know it. I rely on contractors for that.
I'm astounded by that last answer, that you wouldn't know anything about residential building codes, because that would seem to be an area that real estate people might know something about. Anyway, with that comment aside, you're a real estate licensee and associate broker, so you must work under a broker. And who is the broker that you work under?
It's Core Real Estate Group, LLC.
It's whom?
Core.
Core.
Real Estate Group, LLC.
Group, LLC. And where are they headquartered out of?
Eagle River, Alaska.
And who is the principal broker there?
There's two brokers there, Derek Hurt and Annalisa Cooper.
And how long have you worked there?
Well, they just started a few years ago. I helped them get their business started. I want to about 3 years now.
So who did you work for before that?
Before that, we worked with a company called Signature, and then before that, we worked with Exit.
And where are both of those located out of?
They were located out of Eagle River. However, I don't know what their current status is.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do we have further questions, Representative Thiels?
Thank you. Mr. Tavolaro, on June 4th, 2017, you retweeted a tweet by a gentleman named Paul Joseph Watson, and the tweet said, Theresa May says terror ideology is, quote, a perversion of Islam. She obviously hasn't read the Quran. So in retweeting that, is it your belief that actually terrorist ideology is an Islamic teaching?
I'm sorry, I missed the end of that question.
Is it, you retweeted on June 4th, 2017, you retweeted a tweet that said, Theresa May says terror ideology is, quote, a perversion of Islam, end quote. She obviously hasn't read the Quran. So is it, in retweeting that, were you trying to say that terrorist ideology actually is part of Islamic teachings?
You know, I don't even remember the Twitter.
Let me read you another tweet that you retweeted. June 3rd, 2017.
I don't really have that Twitter account. Go ahead.
Individual named Brandon Peck tweeted, make no mistake, these medieval butchers won't stop. Islam is not compatible with Western civilization. Hashtag London Bridge, hashtag Ramadan, hashtag UK. And then the reason I'm asking these questions is because on May 27, 2017, you tweeted, and this is you writing, I think, you quote, you can't be polite or tolerable of those who blindly and deftly want to kill you. Our only option is to destroy them. That's the same day that you wrote, people of Mindanao support President Duterte's efforts to kill all the terrorists, exclamation point. As you know, Rodrigo Duterte has been widely criticized for murdering civilians in his country. So I read you these series of tweets because I want to get clarity. Is it your position that Islam is a threat to Western civilization? And to quote you, our only option is to destroy them.
I don't remember the Twitter comments. Is there a question? Are you saying that I am against Islam?
Well, I asked you a series of questions, and specifically, what you said on Twitter is our only option is to destroy them. You have multiple tweets where you said that terrorist ideology, you suggested that terrorist ideology is actually part of Islamic teachings. I'm not an Islamic scholar and, you know, wouldn't weigh in on that, but that's what you said. And in the same series of tweets, you're praising a president who has been widely criticized for murdering civilians, all of which would lead someone to think, gosh, it seems like Michael Tavolaro has said our only option is to destroy them, in which you're retweeting bigoted statements about Muslims. So what I'm asking is it your position that violence against Muslims is acceptable? Because as you've suggested in your Twitter, this is your belief, not mine, Islam is a threat to Western civilization. That's the question.
No, it's not right.
Follow up. Then why would you write such a thing?
I had a Philippine virtual assistant who set up my accounts, and my thinking is that that might have been part of a conversation that he had using my account. But I don't remember the tweets.
Follow up. Sorry. You have a social media manager who writes stuff for you?
I had a Philippine virtual assistant who helped set up a website and social media accounts.
Who is this individual?
He's no longer with me.
Oh, okay. Well, who is it, though?
Oh, geez. I cannot remember his name off the top of my head. He was with me for a short time.
Follow up. And did this person write tweets on your behalf?
Not to my knowledge.
Wait, you just said yes, why not?
I said not to my knowledge.
Oh, not to your knowledge. Okay.
Can I interject something here?
Please.
Because I'm really confused, because I thought a couple of seconds ago you blamed this person for tweeting on your behalf things that you don't agree with, and now you're saying that you don't know anything about that. So that's just sort of confusing.
Yeah, it's confusing to me because I just don't remember them.
Well, Madam Chairwoman, I guess in closing, these tweets seem to come from the same Michael Tavolaro with whom we're speaking, and they're in the public realm. So I guess I'm left confused about whether he thinks exterminating mass numbers of people of a particular religion is appropriate, which frankly is kind of disturbing. Thank you.
That's not appropriate. And how dare you say that? That is not appropriate.
Well, follow up. Let me just read from your quote, Mr. Tavolaro. You can't be polite or tolerable of those who blindly and deftly want to kill you. Our only option is to destroy them. And I asked you, is that your position? And now you're saying it's not, which I think is probably a more reasonable position than supporting wholesale murder. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
All right. I think we're finished with this line of questioning right now. Do we have any further questions for Mr. Tavolaro. All right. Seeing and hearing no further questions, I would now like to open public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Is there anybody online who would like to testify? Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Seeing and hearing no folks who want to testify, we are going to close public testimony. So are there any committee comments with respect to this appointee? Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll sort of reiterate what I said earlier, that this conversation today started about transparency, and it seems like every turn we take, there's a little less of it. So I left here knowing less than when we started, I suppose. And you had to drill deep to get just basic resume information, which I would think on work experience, you found a lot that wasn't on his resume. Thank you.
Any further comments? Representative Fields.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. On Mr. Tavolaro's resume, he says, I bring business experience to the table. My skills in negotiating, management, relationship building, and community outreach will benefit all. We heard earlier that he was comparing apparently the legislature in general, or Senator Keel in particular, to a criminal investigation in Washington, which he described that as a flippant remark. I find it concerning that he would email all elected officials, all state elected officials in the state of Alaska with flippant remarks. But I'm much more disturbed by a record of espousing a violent ideology, and I just don't think that's appropriate for people in a public position. And of course, I share my colleagues' concerns regarding the lack of transparency, knowledge, and experience that would seem appropriate for this position. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Anybody else want to comment about this appointee? All right. Seeing and hearing no further comments, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The House Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends the following name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration: Michael Tavaliero, Real Estate Commission Board. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
And I would like to just point out to the listening audience that this committee has no choice other than to recommend that appointees be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. So, Mr. Tavalero's name will be forwarded, and after we adjourn, please stay behind to sign the confirmation committee report. So, our next item on the agenda, thank you very much, Mr. Tavalero, for your testimony. The next item on the agenda is HB 48, Temporary State Employees in Partially Exempt Service. This is our first hearing on HB 48. Representative Wilson? And would you like to introduce your bill? And do you have any staff here who might like to come up with you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you here. My name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 3. I sure hope you've gotten it all out of your system now and will be much friendlier with my bill. And I did bring backup. So HB 48, AS 39-25-110-9 was supposed to allow the governor to appoint someone for some temporary and special inquiry. Because they are temporary, exempts do not get PERS or regular state leave, health insurance, or other state benefits. However, the statute has not been used in that manner. It has instead been used to establish positions without the intent of the positions being temporary, which would then entitle employees to PERS and all other benefits. The purpose of HB 48 is to discontinue the historical practice by the executive branch of using AS 39-25-110-9 to unilaterally establish highly paid executive-level temporary exempt positions that have no salary limits. There are positions established many years ago using this statute that still exists today. Some are unbudgeted and do not appear in agency position counts. Several attempts have been made to obtain a complete list of these positions and current salary levels, but these attempts have been unsuccessful. HB 48 is intended to eliminate the establishment of, quote, temporary exempt positions and instead place these positions in a partially exempt service. Persons may be appointed to partially exempt positions. However, they will be subject to salary limits like all other state employees. HB 48 will force the administration to be more transparent and allow all employees to be treated fairly, Madam Chair. And what I found interesting on my FISCO note, it is a zero FISCO note. So I can interpret that one of two ways. One, they don't want to admit they have exempt positions. Or two, it has no impact whatsoever, so they won't care if we get rid of this particular part of the statute. So with that, I will take any questions that you may have.
Do we have any questions for Representative Wilson? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Wilson. My only concern or thought is you've used the words exempt and these temporary exempt phrasing interchangeably. And in looking at the statute and looking at this, it seems that you mean a very narrow scope, only those under 39-25-110-9, which are the temporary. So when you refer to them as exempt, that always catches me off guard because that's a much broader category, including all of our deputy attorney generals are exempt positions, for example. Our guardian ad litems are exempt, for example. And I doubt that either of those are a class of positions that are temporary in nature. So I'm wondering if the term or phrasing of this subcategory should just be temporaries, or that's my concern. And I am sure that you have thought about this in many manifestations, because I find that you've generally mulled things over more elaborately than the previous person we were asking questions of.
Madam Chair, I'm going to call my helpline to make sure that it is correct. And we have mulled this over, made sure that we put it in the right category. And just to, and this is just this one area, so you are right. There are more than one exempt, and this is one specific area that we're looking to take away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ramon Henderson, 8th Representative Wilson. And to Representative Hannon, you're correct that this is specifically designed to only address those temporary positions established by AS 1109, just those, temporary exempt.
Follow up?
I also, through the chair, I kind of presume that what you're envisioning, that these are political appointees for a specific narrow mission, and that perhaps even putting a time frame of how temporary they could be on there. And I don't know if you've thought about that.
Representative Hannon, through the chair. I can't completely answer that because they won't tell us. So that could be correct, but I did get a call last year from an anonymous person who let me know that there was a position in Anchorage that she was very disturbed about. Literally did not leave their number. It took probably a couple of months to finally narrow down to who it was, the individual. They were getting paid an exorbitant amount. It wasn't, as far as I know, anything political at that point. And there was not even a PCN that backed that up. And that, I think, is twofold. First of all, if the governor's office or whatever agency they put in, they have extra monies, they could literally hire somebody, not as a contract, but as an employee, temporary employee, and it's basically no way to be able to find that. And I know Representative Fields has been asking pretty much the same questions as I have been. Or they could be put into a PCN, and unlike others who wouldn't go through this process, you would have to make sure the job classification is correct, and then you'd go through salary benefits to make sure that salary backed up. If you go through this one, you and I could have basically the same title, the same job, and if I went through the governor's, I might get paid possibly twice as much, you know, as you do, just because of the way the statute is. And I believe that that should not happen, and it's time for it to end.
Follow up. And I share your concern, and was, I guess, perceiving of, like, putting a time frame of how long you could be in a temporary exempt position at a year or 2 years, so that after that period of time, because there is a whole process in that same statute about how a position can be made exempt or partially exempt that goes through the personnel board and classification and a public notice period, but still allows that person to be appointed and not go through a probationary hire period like classified jobs do. But, trying to figure out if, because in reading your narrative, it seemed to me you were thinking of these people who were, it was a temporary job that you were hired for, but now it's 10 years later and you're still there and you're off the books in the big radar of books of PCNs. And thinking perhaps if we described or defined how temporary was.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I think it's more than just a temporary part of it. It's really hiding of the funds and hiding who's doing the job for me. You could put a 6 month or a year. I think really the intent was so, and using the gas line as a good example, that you might need somebody with very specialized knowledge to get a project going. And you most likely would have to probably pay them more than the average person because it's a short span and you need it right now. And I just think through the years, it's just been taken further and further off that line. And from just the individual I was talking about, they didn't have any kind of specialty. It should have actually had a PCN, a specific identifier on it. But I think as long as this particular part of the statute is in there, I think it's shown that it's going to be abusive. So I think even just putting 3 or 6 months wouldn't change how they could possibly pay for it, would also not put them through any kind of salary like everybody else has to do. If they need to write a specific contract, we're not taking that away. We're taking it just as an employee.
Thank you. Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you. Can you give me an example of one of those type of jobs?
I can, the Chair, Representative Stoops. Here's a good example.
Do you want to identify yourself?
I am Ramon Henderson speaking, sorry. In the Department of Corrections, there was a unit called an investigative unit. And they were hired, they established positions entitled Special Investigator, Professional Conduct Investigator. In fact, let me give you a specific title. It's called a Professional Investigator, Conduct Investigator. So that position was established as a temporary exempt position using that specific statute that we're talking about. And the salary and benefits for that position was $173,000. And that position was established in FY17, and it still existed until the current commissioner deleted the position in the 20 budget.
Follow up. Thank you again through the chair. Did you say that position with salary and benefits was $173,000? Because I thought that it says that these temporary exempt positions have no benefits.
So, Representative, through the chair, that's how the statute was meant to be. And so they've done it all sorts of ways. The temporary is not supposed to include those. And you have some that aren't because they're not actually down as an employee. It's just a salary and others that they have actually put into positions as well. It's not even utilized anyway as I think the intent was when it was placed into the statutes.
Follow up. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to get this clear in my mind. So you have people that essentially are employees and are receiving a salary and benefits, but they just have no PCN. And you can't find them in the books anywhere.
Representative Stutz, through the chair. Yes, you're right as far as some do have PCNs. Some do not have them. They're literally, if the governor's office say they have a couple hundred thousand dollars that are still in their budget, they could hire someone underneath this statute and not give them a PCN. And that's what makes it so difficult. It's the ones that you can't find in the budget books that are difficult.
Also through the chair, Representative Stutz. Some are identified, for example, in this specific case, by a letter T in front of the last three numbers of the PCN. So this, for example, is 20-T028. So that's how you can identify them sometimes by going through every department and looking to see if they're that. But that's not the if you really want to find out how many they are, the only way to do that would be to contact each department and have them provide you that information. But I just want to make clear that what this bill does is you have exempt employees defined in 3925.120. Those are partially exempt, I'm sorry. Exempt are defined in 3925.110, and it lists all the people that are covered by exempt. Partially exempt are covered in AS 3925.120. And all this does is take that one item that's listed in the exempt and move it over to this classification as partially exempt. That's all it does. And then when it does that, it subjects the appointment to a pay plan that is established in statute for those people that are in partially exempt. So those people in partially exempt not only have a pay plan, they are subject to scrutiny in terms of appointment. The governor or any of the commissioner still has the ability to appoint someone up to a step F unless there are extenuating circumstances and that person has experience that is beyond something that you really need a lot of experience for. You do even have the ability to justify that, but the difference is you have to justify it. You just can't place somebody in a high salary position.
Got it. Thank you.
So, who do you justify it to? So, in other words, if the administration wants to put somebody in a high salary position beyond, for example, the step F, then they just write out, I guess, I'm wondering, do they just write out a justification, and then they're the ones that approve the extenuating circumstances?
Through the chair, our chair, Madam Chair, I believe that has to be viewed by the personnel board. But I would get clarification from the Department of Administration, Division of Personnel, and I will follow up on that. But I believe that's the case. But I will definitely follow up.
I would appreciate that. There are any further questions? Okay. Well, hearing no further questions, I'm going to. I like this bill. But I'm going to hold it, and I want to hear the response to that. I mean, I want to make sure that when we pass something, that it's actually got some teeth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will definitely get that answer to you no later than tomorrow.
All right. Representative Fields.
Could I just make a brief comment?
Go right ahead.
So to my colleague's point, I actually asked Leg Finance and the administration to account for the personnel costs of political appointees in the executive branch, and I haven't gotten an answer to that, either total positions or total costs, and I just appreciate this bill in the interest of transparency. You know, I've been a political appointee myself. I'm not against those appointments. They're an important part of the democratic process, but I think that we all have a right to understand how the executive branch is organized. So I just want to express my appreciation for the bill.
And I think that would be very helpful to have. And perhaps Representative Wilson might be able to follow up on that request.
Madam Chair, I have put the request in so many different ways. I can't even count them, especially just even underneath this. That's why I was very excited to, only I would be excited about getting a fiscal note. But to really see whether or not anybody would admit that there are positions in this. So since it comes out of the governor's office, I'm going to assume that he is okay with this being gone, since he didn't tell us there was any reasons not to.
I guess I don't. I have a difficult time understanding how there wouldn't be a fiscal note, but that it wouldn't be a positive fiscal note. It should probably be a negative fiscal note, and I just having a difficult time comprehending why it would be a zero fiscal note. And I'm hoping that by the time we hear this bill the next time, maybe the administration can enlighten us on that.
And Madam Chair, it goes to finance next, so I'm sure they're going to get the question again up there.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it would be helpful for some of us who aren't in this issue every day, maybe the definition exempt and partially exempt as defined in our state system. And also, I'm curious, PCNs, we use that phrase a lot, that personal control number.
Correct.
So if everyone that's working for the state as one of those categories has a PCN, in other words, they're sort of accounted for. And you said some people do, some people don't. I guess maybe that's the issue that you're trying to get to the bottom of, which is good. And it seems like if we're accounting for every other thing in the budget, what we're paying people and what they're doing, it seems to be a pretty basic condition of transparency, I guess. That's kind of the word of the day today, so I'll stick with it.
And Reverend Wolf, through the chair, we'll get you those definitions out of statute. I want to let you know, though, this last time when I went through the budget, I actually found two people with the same PCN number. So I found that very strange as well. It's amazing what you do when you dig down deep enough.
So I'm going to take a brief at ease here. Until Wednesday, March 20th, we'll have public testimony at that time. I understand Representative Wilson may be able to get us some answers to some of those questions. I think it would be really helpful if someone from the administration might want to answer some of those questions also. So we'll do that on Wednesday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. So our last item on today's agenda is HB 44, Automated Teller Machines and Fees. This is our first hearing on HB 44.
For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz. I represent District 36, Southern Southeast Alaska.
And for the record, Caroline Hamp, staff to Representative Ortiz.
Okay, so my script says, would you like to join us at the table, but you beat me to the punch on that already. Okay. So do you want to go over the bill and let us know what it does?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair Ledoux and Co-Chair Wolf. It is indeed a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to present to this committee House Bill 44, the Automated Teller Machines Fees Bill. It's a short and simple bill that we had moved through the process all the way up to the finish line last year, and so we're going to make another attempt this particular year. I believe it was heard between in the Labor and Commerce Committee in the last go-around as well. What does the bill do? It allows individually owned ATMs to charge a fee on transactions by international cardholders. Another word for individually owned would be privately owned ATMs. To charge fees on transactions by international cardholders. It closes a gap in the current law. The current ATMs statute pertains to bank-owned ATMs. So if you're an owner of an ATM, let's say at Wells Fargo, you can charge international users to use the teller machine in that particular, that kind of an institution. HB 44 would close the gap by including a section on individually or privately owned ATMs. So for example, if Representative Wool was still a bar owner, I understand he's not, if he had an ATM in his establishment, right now, if an international user comes into his establishment, Representative Wool cannot charge any fee for that international user to use that particular privately owned ATM.
Can he charge a non-international person?
Yes, he can, and I'm sure he does. this law would close the gap so that privately owned ATMs can also charge international users. And you're correct, Madam Co-Chair Ledoux. Currently, those folks can charge domestic card users, and sometimes we've heard through when discussing this bill with private owners, we've heard that they are almost forced to charge higher rates to domestic users to make up for the rates that they're not currently being able to charge international users. And if you think about it, particularly in some communities, we do have a growing number of international travelers that travel through the state of Alaska, particularly in my community, but throughout, I'm sure, the fine community of Fairbanks as well. So in any case, this bill would allow private owners to set a fee for withdrawals made by international card users. This would increase their revenue from international tourists. We have received support for this bill from Alaskan owners of ATMs, from the organization known as CHAR, as well as the National ATM Council. And we hope to have your support, your committee's support for this bill as well. You can take a look at the sponsor statement if you choose to, a little bit more information there, but I'm open for questions.
All right, Representative Stutz and then Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just for my information and maybe others, can you tell me the difference between an international user and a regular user?
Sure. It'd be anybody from a foreign country other than the United States.
Follow up. So that must mean a bank other than a bank located in the U.S. Is that correct? Is that the difference? It relates to the bank? I would think it would almost have to, because otherwise, how are you going to know they're an international user?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, it's not the person's nationality. It's the bank of the card. It's the cardholder's bank.
So if it's, thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair, Co-Chair, thank you. So it relates to a bank that is not a U.S. bank.
Correct.
Thank you.
Good question.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. So I guess our Swiss bank account cards won't work at ATMs. No, actually, my question. So
work,
this,
you just can't get charged a fee.
Well, that was my
they
question.
They work pretty well, actually.
Can a private owner, and I'm not at all opposed to this, I guess my presumption was if you couldn't charge a fee, that your card wouldn't work. But now I'm hearing and seeing one of my constituent who has an ATM in his business shaking his head that the international card holder can use the ATM, but no fee can be recovered.
That's
correct. Are ATM owners allowed to block users if they couldn't charge a fee?
I don't know the answer to that question. I do not know the answer to that question.
Representative Wall may have an answer to that question.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And in full disclosure, I do have a conflict of interest. I do own an ATM machine. I do receive payment from card holders that use my machine. To answer Representative Hannon's question, let me explain. excuse me. I have to cough again, I think. My machine is doesn't go through a bank. I bought it from a private company, and they process all the transactions, and then they send me a check every month. So if a person with a foreign card tries to get money, I don't know if the company can oh, that's hot coffee. I didn't know if the company can automatically block it if it doesn't like the bank it's going through. I don't know. They don't tell me. They just tell me how many transactions and how much money I get. So it could be that the foreign cardholder gets their money but just doesn't get charged a fee. Now, if I could suddenly recoup some of that money, thank you very much, would I lower my fee because now I'm making more money on the people that I wasn't before? Probably not, no. I would still get my $3 a transaction or whatever it is. So, but I guess it might as well get the charge when you can, especially places that have a lot of foreign cards. So, and I remember hearing this bill last year, and I supported it back then, too.
Representative Stutes.
Oh, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, I just want to make sure I understand this. So this fee is like when you go to a bank other than your own bank. If I go to a bank that I don't bank with, then they charge you like $3 or whatever it is. This doesn't have anything to do with the exchange rate. It's just simply the fee that is you're being charged for not going to your own bank to get the dough.
Gotcha. That is correct.
Thank you.
And we have a couple of people online or maybe in the audience who might be able to answer some of these questions. We have Bruce Renard from the National ATM Council. Is he here or is he online?
He's online.
He's online. We're questioning.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, this is Mr. Renard, and I am online with you here.
Thank you. Want to identify the outfit that you're with?
Sure, I'm happy to. I'm the executive director of the National ATM Council.
And can you answer that
question? Independent ATM providers throughout the U.S., including in Alaska.
Thank you.
And that's my position.
Thank you. Can you give us an answer to that question as to whether or not private ATM machine owners can block foreign transactions?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And let me point out as well, it's really kind of a misnomer to refer to these ATMs as private, because every ATM has to have a sponsoring bank to sponsor its deployment. So in some cases, it's the bank's own ATMs. Typically, the largest banks have their own fleets of ATMs. But in fact, 60% of the ATMs in America are provided by entrepreneurs, small and medium businesses, oftentimes mom and pop or family businesses. And but all of those are operated pursuant to the bank sponsorship. So they're really not private. We refer to them as independent ATMs. And it turns out in the study that we submitted to the committee in response to the bill, these ATMs typically provide service in the lower income, you know, lower socioeconomic communities where there are no bank branches.
Mr. Renard, you're here, or I'm hoping to get you under public testimony where we can deal with some of this information. If you could just answer the question about blocking.
Certainly, Madam Co-Chair, I'm sorry. Technically, the blocking could be done, but I believe it would be a violation of the network rules. All ATMs are subject to compliance with the global network rules of Visa, MasterCard, and the other networks, the financial networks, and I don't think they would look kindly upon blocking. So we're kind of in a catch-22 where we do have to provide access for these type transactions, even though technically we probably could block them. But this is really a glitch with Alaska, to our knowledge, being the last state that has this glitch in the law. So that's
interesting that you mentioned that you'd be if somebody tried to block it, that you'd be in violation of network rules. Because I'm always, you know, when I travel, I will often go to a country and they'll have two or three ATM machines there, and my Wells Fargo ATM card may only work in one of the machines. And then there are another couple of machines that don't take that Wells Fargo ATM card.
Yes. When you get into the international travel situation that you've described, absolutely. Different countries have different protocols. Your Visa or MasterCard card should work everywhere. And one of the reasons that they are, as dominant as they are is because they do have, typically network facilities in these remote places where there are no other financial networks. But, typically ATMs should be able to accept U.S. cards abroad. But if not, it's typically unique to that country or the way they're doing things. And unfortunately, there's not a complete uniformity of the global basis that we have, at least within the U.S. today.
All right. Thank you. So do we have any other questions for either Representative Ortiz or Ms. Hemp or Mr. Renard at the moment? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And through the chair, and just so it's on the record, I intend to support this legislation. It seems to be a significant thing in a place where we have a lot of international travelers. But the part that Alaska is the only state remaining, did we have to pass a statute that allowed us to charge ATM fees for domestic users? And I'm curious because the list of banks in one of the studies are all nationally chartered banks. And I guess it's interesting to me that in a industry that is so controlled by the federal government, that state by state, this component has to be dealt with, as opposed to we've sanctioned and allow you to have transactions with them. But is it just the international fees that were excluded and everything else about ATMs was covered by federal banking law?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that is my understanding, and that, as the gentleman just spoke to, back when they were setting the regulations around ATM use, somehow private, individually owned ATM owners were left out of the equation. So at this time, institutions like Wells Fargo can charge a fee, but for whatever reason, Alaska remains the one place where individually owned ATMs cannot charge international users. And passing this bill would just make us on board with 49 other states.
Thank you. Any further questions? Well, then I am now going to open up public testimony. And it looks like we have, for questions, we have Patrice Walsh, the director of the Division of Banking and Security. And then we have Nancy, it says Nancy S., deputy director of the Department of Administration. And so why don't we start with Bruce Renard for testimony.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And again, thanks to the committee for taking this bill up, and thanks to Representative Ortiz for sponsoring it and bringing it back up this session. As was mentioned previously, the bill had a pretty thorough hearing, to our understanding, through the process last year, made it all the way through to the very end, and we just ran out of time before it could be finalized and ultimately enacted. And we've really, I think, covered the essence of the need for the bill in the discussion so far today, which is it's truly a glitch that is specific to state of Alaska and its interaction with the global network rules. And that interaction has resulted in the inability of the independent ATMs to be able to charge a reasonable fee for the use by cardholders with cards from international banks when they're in Alaska, using ATMs, independent ATMs in Alaska. And this bill will remedy that situation. As with all other surcharges that are actually imposed by the ATM owner themselves, these have to be, under federal law, disclosed on the ATM screen at the time of the transaction, and the consumer given an opportunity to opt out of the transaction if they feel the fee is too high. And this has worked extremely well in the marketplace when we, as a trade association, have looked at these ATM surcharges generally. Despite, or I guess in contrast to some news headlines, the actual ATM owner surcharges have remained very low and not really increased over the years because they're, you know, disclosed at the time of the transaction, and we have an excellent availability of ATMs in the U.S. so that people can, you know, walk down the block and use a different one if the surcharge is too high. So this disclosure requirement, the ability to opt out, would apply to these surcharges as well. And that whole environment has really resulted in these ATM surcharges remaining reasonable in the $2 to $3 range, as mentioned earlier. With that said, there has been, you know, press out there that ATM fees are skyrocketing, and I always like to take the opportunity to correct the record on that to say the actual ATM owner fees are not doing that. But what's happened is the issuing banks have begun charging ATM fees when their cardholders use an ATM other than the bank's own ATMs. So, for instance, if you're a Wells Fargo cardholder and you use an independent ATM, and let's say you check your balance and then withdraw your money, the ATM owner may charge you $250 as, you know, the surcharge for using the machine. And it's very cost justified, as the representative who spoke earlier, who has an ATM, can attest. It's a labor-intensive business, and there's a fair amount of cost associated with it. Keeping a box of money out there in the public with essentially a computer, a computerized device, is not easy. And so you'll be charged the $250 from the ATM owner, but then Wells Fargo will charge you $5. $250 for checking your balance, and another $250 for the withdrawal. And so altogether, it's a pretty hefty charge, but, you know, we can't control the bank charges. We can only control what we impose. And our fees are disclosed at the time of the transaction. The bank fees basically show up on your statement at the end of the month, and there's not, you know, it's not not practical because there's so many variations on the bank fees. Technically, it's not possible really to disclose them at the time of the transaction. So if you have to basically go to the website to see what those are. In any event, this law, proposed law, HB 44, would fix the glitch that's currently in Alaska law and bring the state into, you know, the same position as all the other states in the country, which allow these ATMs to charge fees to international cardholders, the same as they do for domestic cardholders. And by doing that, creating a level playing field between the bank-owned and the independent-owned ATMs, and not, in effect, having a cross-subsidy between Alaska cardholders and international cardholders at these terminals. So we very much appreciate your consideration of the bill, and it has our full support. And thanks again for your consideration, and I'm available for any questions you may have.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Renard. Anybody have any questions? All right. Well, again, thank you. I'm going to go now to Paul Thomas here in the Juneau LIO.
Thank you, Paul Thomas. I have an independent liquor store down here, and I have an ATM in it, and I also run 14 other ATMs here in the city. And this bill, as everybody's been saying, is just going to put us independents on par with everybody else in the rest of the states, local banks. The closer you get to the departure point for those international travelers, the bigger the impact this has on you as an ATM operator. And of course, all of our towns are right there at the departure for cruise ship international passengers. So as you get closer to that dock, in our case, you see more of these no charge fees that can move the needle on what you're charging for a surcharge. So I just urge you guys to please put us on an even playing field with everybody else in the states.
Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions? All right, thank you. And we finally have Sarah Oates. Sarah, are you online?
Hi, yes, Madam Co-Chair, I'm on the phone.
So you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Yes, thank you. My name is Sarah Oates, and I am the president and CEO of the Alaska Cabaret Hotel, Restaurant, and Retailers Association, commonly known as Alaska Char. I represent residents across all of Alaska, many of whom have independently owned ATMs in their establishments. We are very supportive of this bill, as it would allow for small and privately owned ATM operators to collect a fee that large financial institutions are already allowed to collect. Current law puts small business owners at a disadvantage by forcing them to eat the cost of international fees rather than passing them on to the consumers. So Alaska Char fully supports this very fair piece of legislation that would help small Alaskan businesses. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Is there anybody else, either online or in the audience, who would like to testify? Not seeing anyone, we're going to close public testimony. Any committee discussion? All right. Well, then amendments to this bill should be in my office no later than Tuesday, which is tomorrow at 5 p.m. We're going to hold this bill and hear it again on Wednesday, March 20th, at which point it would be my intention to move the bill out of committee. Our next hearing will be on Wednesday, March 20th, 2019 at 3:15 p.m. We stand adjourned, and it is 4:34. And remember to stay.